The Naturalistic Decision Making Podcast with Brian Moon and Laura Militello. This podcast series brings you interviews with leading NDM researchers who study and support people who make decisions under stress. Welcome to the Naturalistic Decision Making Podcast. This is Laura Militello from Applied Decision Science.
And I'm Brian Moon from Perigene Technologies. Our special guest today is Christian Madsberg. Christian is interested in human worlds, human perception, and the skill of observation, which is reflected in the diversity of his professional experience. He's been a full-time professor of applied humanities at the New School for Social Research, a senior fellow at the Health and Global Policy Institute in Tokyo, Japan, and a distinguished visitor at the Buffett Center for International Affairs at Northwestern University in Chicago. He co-founded Red Associates, a pioneering consultancy with offices in Copenhagen, Paris, London, and New York City, and a health data startup, Lateral Data, based in Dallas, Texas. His board appointments include chairman of the top-tier architectural firm, Bjarke Ingels Group, independent director of the luxury furniture manufacturer, Fritz Hansen, independent director and nomination governance committee chairman at the battery metals company, The Metals Company, member of the high-end home textiles manufacturer, Kavir Drat, and board member at Red Associates Holding. His work has been featured in publications such as The Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, Financial Times, Der Spiegel, and Bloomberg Businessweek. And he's the author of three books, The Moment of Clarity, Using the Human Sciences to Solve Our Toughest Business Problems, Sense Making, The Power of the Humanities in the Age of the Algorithm, and just released Look, How to Pay Attention in a World of Distraction. Welcome, Christian. Thank you for joining us. We're super excited that you're here.
So am I. That sounds like a long list when you listen to it like that.
It is a very long list, and some of those names I'm sure I botched, but we'll talk about your international outlook throughout the podcast, I'm sure. So I want to start off just to thank you for providing the keynote talk at our NDM 2022 conference. We heard from lots of delegates who were in the room and online that it was really the highlight of the conference. And I was thinking about this podcast, and I remembered a conversation we had leading up to your keynote when I was trying to get you to come deliver it. And you kind of characterized NDM as psychologists doing anthropology, which I thought was a very clever way of putting it. And as your bio suggests, you've been very involved in business. And I'm wondering if it might be fair to characterize your career as sort of an anthropologist or philosopher doing business. Is that reflective of the things that you've done?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good description. Trying to push tools from philosophical texts or from anthropological practices into the world of business or making decisions, making big decisions, really.
Yeah, I think that that's a real strong parallel with us in the NDM communities, taking these models and methods from naturalistic psychology and pushing them into business in another application. So I've always felt that was a strong affinity to the work that you have done. You mentioned during the talk that you thought your colleagues, who are anthropologists, can benefit from some of the structures of our approaches like cognitive task analysis. Your latest book, Look, How to Pay Attention in a World of Distraction, is really about observations, which my personal reflection is that we in the NDM community don't do enough observation. But I wonder if we can kind of dive into a bit of a methodological chat about the kinds of approaches that we have with cognitive task analysis being primarily retrospective interviews and the approach that you're recommending others take on in your book and in your practice, that is observation kind of real time out in the real world. And I wonder if you have a perspective on the appropriate uses for both, you know, beyond the sort of obvious temporal reasons. You can look at things now, but only ask about things that happened in the past. Do you have a kind of a perspective, a methodological perspective?
I mean, I love talking about methodology. I could talk about that all day. But I think what happened in the social sciences, human sciences, is that economics had a form of physics envy. Like if only we could make models that would be predictive and that would be true at the ground level, so all the way down, then we could predict the economic changes in the world and we could see how high the inflation would be or how inflation relates to growth and so on. And of course, that project of making societies and economics into scientific system that can be likened with physics was, of course, I mean, bananas. Then what happened, I think, is that psychology had a form of economics envy, that the psychological kind of community started to use experiments and different kinds of tools that where you could isolate variables in order to have a data empirical kind of ground to stand on. And that economics envy, of course, came out of a need for data. So what's cool about economics is that they have real data, whereas a lot of the other practices, philosophy in particular, have very little data. So that sort of economics envy led to methods that were, I don't know, simple and often too simple, and where the conclusions that sort of was extracted from that work often were, I think, banal or wrong. And you see that right now, of course, in this big scandal in coming out of the happiness studies and so on that was done in behavioral economics and psychology. So I'm a big fan of science and I really like experiments. But on the other hand, there's a limit to the conclusions you can take from that sort of technique of having a group of graduate students react to something, then isolate a variable, and then you suddenly conclude that happiness comes from something. You know, it's just silly how you take very, very complicated human systems and make them into very banal, singular parameters.
Yeah, so again, lots of affinity in our community with those ideas. And I wonder if you could sort of take us back in your own experience. I mean, where you're at, where lots of folks in our community are at in thinking about proper methods and the way to study phenomena, obviously lots of folks out there are not in that same place. And entire programs, research programs, and university departments are focused on continuing to do what you just described. And I wonder if you could sort of walk us through how you came to this realization that, you know, the methods of the day, the dominant sort of paradigms are really not going to be that useful.
For me, it was studying economics and the economics profession and how they make decisions and how wrong, like they're always wrong. When they predict the next recession, they've done that the last 8 years, said that the next recession is right around the corner. And they're sort of pretty systematically always wrong. And I just thought that was curious. And then, of course, the root of that is the modeling, the mathematically based modeling that was also used, by the way, to predict activity during the COVID era and also very wrong all the time. So this idea that you can model the world based on very, very simple assumptions, and then you can predict massive changes, I just don't buy. I like modeling, but I think there's something that has to come before the modeling, which is observation. And I think with your community, at least what I learned about when I went to meet all of you in Florida last year, right? Yeah, last year, was that many of the people there have given up on just having that one method, and that looking at human decision-making and human skill has to go beyond narrow experiments in a psychology lab and has to happen in the world with all the many parameters involved. And for me, the only tool for that is ethnographic practice. So I'm not saying that modeling is wrong. I'm not saying that experiments are wrong. In fact, I actually very much think we need it. I'm just thinking that what has to come before you start doing any experiment is open-ended, open-minded observation of the phenomena before you start creating hypotheses. So abductive reasoning or hypothesis creation has to come before you design those experiments. And then together, it's fantastic. What happened in the anthropology world, which is also has lots of problems involved, is that they stop at the observation and they don't test their hypotheses. They just claim massive things based on fieldwork with 12 informants and, you know, something like that, which is also ridiculous. So I think it's the combination of methods that can get to something interesting and insightful and maybe even true.
Yeah, that issue of truth and wrongness, as you said earlier, I mean, so you saw the continuation of wrongness in the economics world. What, this is speculative purely, but what do you think attracts people to continue to sort of press those approaches and revise methods to try to get closer to rightness, even when the foundational method is wrong? In your experience, what sort of drives economists and folks who are continuing in those psychological paradigms to just keep trying to make it work?
Well, I think we all do that in some level, but economics is particularly grotesque. So in order to become a tenured professor in economics, particularly in a prestigious kind of faculty, you have to publish in particular journals. I think there are 3 or 4 major journals. And when you do that, you get points, literally points. And you need a certain amount of points in order to get tenure. And if you publish in, if you write books or if you publish in other ways than those ways, you don't get any points. And that means that being on the editorial boards of these reviews is highly prestigious, because you basically have a chokehold on the entire economics profession. And then you will basically weed out anyone that's not interested in the way that you write those papers. And those papers are highly theoretical and mathematical, which, you know, is one method, but there are many more, and there are many other ways of looking at economics. So really the problem is, you could call it the anthropology of the economics profession. It's the way you get to prestigious positions is a very sort of a narrowing track or a narrowing path, where if you're interested in any other way of looking at the world and in any other method, you're basically out. And then you can end up as an adjunct somewhere in Indiana forever. And there's nothing wrong with Indiana, but if you want to go to Princeton, you know, it's not what you wanted in the first place. So it's the anthropology of it that they stick to a particular paradigm. But I mean, if you think about Kuhn's idea of paradigms, is that at one point it breaks down. And after that point, it's so obvious to everyone that the previous paradigm was wrong. So they're repairing, patching over, excusing, you know, all those kinds of things are happening, which is more an anthropological, you know, question than anything else.
You mentioned the controversies going on right now. I mean, there's the replication controversy in psychology. There's the forged data controversies as well. I mean, those are the sorts of things that bring about paradigm change, at least in the Kuhnian model. I'm wondering, are you seeing other evidence that we might be in the throes of such a paradigm change?
I don't know. I mean, I think it's a pretty solid paradigm still. I mean, you can say the scandal is that there people are messing with the data sets in order to have clearer conclusions. That's something, I mean, anybody that works with data have done some version of in their life. So I'm not so shocked about that. It's the funny side of that scandal is, of course, that the work was about truth and how we relate to honesty and truth. And then data set was not very honest, which is funny. But the real tragedy or the real scandal is that society, and particularly the media, feels that that method is even relevant to the kinds of conclusions that they're making. Like, it's such a strong paradigm, and the media world wants to quote studies. That's what they want all the time, to quote a study says X or Y. And it, actually, if you want to write an op-ed, it's very difficult not to quote some sort of study. And those studies are just pretty neat because they're simple and they're easy to explain and so on. So I think the real scandal is that that method has the kind of sway it has, and that the conclusions based on that method is not, you can't replicate it. And quite often it's, I don't know, not very close to the complexities of a problem and not a very good or insightful method. So I don't know. I think behavioral economics has gotten way more attention than it should. I think it's often boring. I think many of the methods that they use are boring and not irrelevant, but something that has to come on top of observational research, where you're willing to scrutinize your assumptions to the level all the way to that you might be wrong about everything. I don't think that's happening at the level you would wish.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned the media angle there, because you know there's the academic entrenchment of these kinds of ideas and approaches, which you went through in a curt but accurate way. But the media piece here is also big. One of my professional interests is in violence and why people commit violence. And every time there's some shooting or recently the serial killer, I mean, you just get folks coming out of the woodwork with these very simplistic and, to use your word, wrong theories about it. But it's what the media hangs on to because it's an easy, quick story to tell, makes nice headlines. And I think you can see in that field as well, this struggle of getting back to, or getting to, maybe we were never there, getting to these fundamental observations and naturalistic understandings of phenomena that just get lost along the way because, like you suggest, they're complex, they're nuanced, they're going to take that kind of effort for someone to not only dig in and do the research, but also for someone learning about it to take the time and take the careful review of the evidence to really come to an understanding. And so the media role here in just glomming on to those quick, easy, wrong versions of the world, it seems to be plaguing all of us who are trying to promote this naturalistic approach.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, you could say on the other side of that argument is, of course, that anthropology standing alone is highly dubious. Like the idea that you do observational studies with a very small sample size, and then you conclude that that's true for everything and everyone. And the right way or the right approach is, of course, to do anthropologically inspired or observational studies and then design solid experiments that I think psychologists are excellent at, and that I know your community is excited about. Because if you can't prove things or disprove things based on an experiment, then it might not be as insightful as you would hope it was. And the same goes with much larger data sets, from where you use technological tools to test enormous data sets. Unless you can design experiments or research based in that world, then I would be highly, I don't know, I'd be concerned if I was a decision maker. So, you know, when my former company looked at, for instance, electric trucks and people's relationship to electric technologies in the automotive world, then we did massive research around the world. But if you're the CEO and you have to bet the entire company based on electric technologies, whether you should or shouldn't, and which type of technology you want to implement in your entire vehicle fleet, if that was based just on that, that would be very uncomfortable. So you have to afterwards do experiments and run more quantitative things at a much, much larger scale in order to get any kind of comfort with anthropology. So I think any of those sciences or any of those tools alone are worrisome. And I know that the best companies and the best government agencies are doing both or all of those methods. And I think that's the right way to go.
So I want to jump in here. I feel like another part of this puzzle is that observational research is hard to do. It's hard to get access. It takes a long time. It takes a long time to carefully analyze all that qualitative data. And people tend to want answers quickly, whether it's a grant or a company. So I'm wondering how you have managed those kinds of challenges.
Yes, it's the heaviest, most cumbersome, dirtiest kind of research, because you've got to go, right? So if you like the electric vehicle studies I just talked about, if you want to study people using trucks or pickup trucks, you have to go to places where that happens. And that's not, you know, on 13th Street in New York, where I live. So you have to go to outback of Australia and deep in Brazil and all over the Midwest in America. And you have to do that for quite a while. So you're away from your family and you're away from sort of your daily routines. And it's expensive. It's really expensive to send highly qualified, expensive people to do this kind of work. And then once you've done observations for months, then you have to organize all that, which is, you know, terabytes of video footage and imagery and quotes and observations and field notes, and all that takes time. And then at that point, you can sort of make sense of it. So what I found quite early in my career was I need money. You know, I need serious resources to do this. And then I thought, like, where do they have that? And it turns out they have that at the top of the biggest companies. It's not so much in the startup world. It's not always in the government world. It can be, but more in maybe the armed forces and intelligence communities have more than your usual sort of school and education system. And they have it sometimes in the hospital system. So I just found that the only place I could get to do work well was places with a lot of resources and where the top management could sign off on the kind of budgets that I needed to do the work well. And quite early in the days, my partners and I in the firm just made a decision that it's that or nothing, because otherwise we'll do really bad work. We'll do superficial work and then we might as well go open a restaurant or something instead. It was just, you know, either or. And we then somehow, out of luck and maybe also working really hard, we found ourselves in situations where we could actually convince people to part ways with large amounts of resources for us to go and do the things we wanted to do.
And do you find that there's this constant pressure? So can you give me some preliminary findings? What have you learned so far? We need to be able to brief this to keep the funding continuing. Do you get those kinds of pressures throughout?
Of course, yeah. And could you do it a little faster, you know? And the answer is no. You know, sorry, we can't. And the people in the top of most large companies are very sophisticated and very smart and understand methodological questions and understand, I think, that things can be expensive. And you have to scope it in the level, at the right level. And also they're used to the world of consulting and investment banking and legal advice, that things can be quite expensive. Whereas if you work in the research group or in the insights, you know, part of any company, they can't do that. They have locked in budgets. A lot of the process is run by procurement offices and so on. And that's just not for the kind of work I've done. You have to get all the way up. And when you do, you end up working with the smartest people, making the biggest decisions. And that's fun, you know, and you can influence bigger things that way. But of course, you have to be lucky enough, like we were, to find ourselves in those rooms where those kinds of things could happen. So you're right. I mean, it's a pressure for everyone, and it's been for probably every single project I've ever been involved in. But the answer is no, sorry. And then people get it when you do it that way.
Wow, impressive. Yeah. I feel like I get those questions and I try to find a way to do something. I don't just say no. So, which is really the right thing to do. Yeah. Yeah.
It's hard because if you need the work, then you can't say no. So I think it's also calibrating your organization so that you have the luxury of saying no. And you have the luxury of losing business and, you know, slimming your pipeline because you say no. But you can still handle it. You can still sort of manage to pay bills and salaries and so on. And it's quite important. The second thing is also price, that the price of something, how much it costs to do a study, has to be high enough that it, one, is a given good. Like it's basically a different relationship between supply and demand, that there's some products like Birkin bags, for instance, that the higher the price, the higher the demand. And I think for top level research, that's the case as well. And second, higher prices means that you can afford saying no or losing things in other places. So really high prices is helpful in so many ways.
So I want to circle back to your latest book. So this is a book where you've really taken this philosophical, methodological issues and really tried to make them very accessible to the public. So, you know, people who maybe don't think about these things all the time can really start to think this way and benefit from that. And my understanding is you've had a very positive reception to this. I'm wondering, has there been anything that has surprised you about the response to this book?
Yes. I mean, that there was a response at all, you know, surprised. It's a very weird book. It is personal in the sense that I'm trying to describe what influenced me over the years, like what were the books and artworks and movies and music that and philosophy that inspired me over the years, and that I made into a class at the New School, which became this sort of iconic class at the New School in Manhattan. But I never thought that a lot of people would be that interested in it. So getting a response is surprising. I think the second thing is that people's response is highly emotional, that it is, oh God, I need this. You know, I feel I'm languishing. I feel I'm leading an abstract life. And this gives me a tool set to get back into a direct relationship to the world, where you observe the world directly rather than either droning through it or having opinions about it. And people say that that touches them. It sort of helps them. It feels healthy to do it. So there's almost like a kind of wellness response that I definitely didn't see coming.
Interesting. That must be very fulfilling.
Yeah, it's first surprising, then wow, I didn't think of that when I wrote it. But it makes sense in a way. You could say that if you lead a life where other people is what you see through screens, and where the primary way that you operate in the world is that you have opinions about things rather than describing them directly, then of course, when you stop doing that and you enter a world that is raw and direct, because you observe what's really there rather what you think is there or what you feel you know is there, then you relate to it in a different way. So people say, I feel better, I feel healthy because of it. I feel closer to the people around me, I feel closer to my community, I feel closer to my city, because I've started observing it in this new way after they've read the book. So that's delightful. It's just thrilling.
Yeah, I did notice actually when I was ordering my copy that it was rating pretty high on pop psychology lists on Amazon. And I'm glad to hear you describe why that is the case, because that's not where I would have put the book. But yeah, interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, pop psychology is perfect. That's where I want to be.
So the book's full of great stories. You tell great stories in your other books, and you certainly told us a number of great stories at the conference. And so storytelling seems to be a big part of your success and your colleagues. And I'm wondering if storytelling was a primary approach for you to deliver your findings to your clients. I think sometimes we in the NDM community struggle a bit with, as you said before, there's all this data out there, and how do we bring that to people who aren't used to dealing with that kind of data? What kind of guidance do you suggest? Maybe it's storytelling, maybe it's beyond storytelling, for kind of realizing the full potential of these qualitative findings that are so voluminous in these kinds of works.
I mean, Gillian Tett, my friend who is at the Financial Times, she told me before I wrote the first book, first American book, that you got to tell it as stories. If you want Americans to read, or the Anglo-Saxon world to read your books, then you have to tell it as stories. And I just took that advice and started explaining fairly deep philosophical ideas, but in a way where it's framed as a series of stories. So that means, I mean, that's also the reaction to the book. There's people that say it's too light because it's told as stories. And then there are people that say it's too heavy because it has philosophy kind of grounding. And that's fine. Both of those, I understand those responses. Yeah, so telling a complicated point or making a complicated point through stories helps people understand it. And I don't understand why anyone would not do that, because the way I've seen people take in deep, complicated, maybe even provocative insight, scientific insight, has to be wrapped in a aesthetic, delightful, fun way. Otherwise, it just won't work. And this is even at the most, like the high stakes crisis kind of situations. So it's just a way of telling the stories. And if you look at the work that you do, it's very data heavy, but you can still tell stories based on that. You can still frame it in a way. And at Red, we used to call it storylining, that unless it's telling a major point through a series of, like, that's framed as a story, you can tell stories with data, and you can tell stories with, you know, outcomes of the kind of research that you do. So I would highly recommend that if you want to communicate these things.
Yeah, I think, you know, we always talk about the work of Gary Klein, and he's a great storyteller. And I think a lot of his success is being able to take the stories we gather and turn them into learning points to sort of illustrate the kinds of, you know, modeling that we do. Yeah. I think storytelling is a skill. I think we maybe don't talk enough in our community about how to tell good stories, even though we're really good at capturing them. But it does feel like that is a skill to sort of pull together, especially from voluminous data that we get in these kinds of research projects, how to pull out the right stories to tell, and then how to tell them well, either in text or, I mean, I'm sure you've also getting in front of those top level folks at those big companies, you're going to tell it as a verbal story.
Yeah, exactly. There is a book that I would recommend anyone that have trouble organizing big data or big research projects in stories. It's called The Pyramid Principle by Barbara Minto. And it's basically the way to take very complicated ideas and structuring them in a way that people can listen to, you know, can understand. I give it to my students. I use it daily, the methods coming out of that. It's a brilliant, brilliant book. So The Pyramid Principle by Barbara Minto.
Thank you. I will check that out. But speaking of students, I know you have worked with a lot of students over the years. And I'm wondering, what has your experience been in introducing them to the power of observation? Where do they struggle? Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about how this works with students?
Yes. Yeah. So students are delightful, first of all, and so fun to be around. But I think increasingly, at least where I taught, they are taught to have opinions about everything. Very, you know, weak opinions, strongly held. And that annoys me because that's not observation. That's just having opinions. And it's basically knowing, thinking that you know what you will learn before you've even looked. So basically, we called it the great excavation, where you get rid of people's opinions and say, that's irrelevant. I don't care what you think. I care about how you think. I care about what you learn, but I don't care about what your opinions are. So that's unusual in modern university environments, in the social sciences at least. So that helped a lot. The second thing is sending them out and looking at things that aren't pleasant. You know, it's easy to look at things that are cute or pleasant, but I would send these people out and to do observation, like significant long-term observations of topics that they chose themselves, of course, but that were more raw. So I would have people look at homelessness. What's it like? The phenomenon of not knowing where to sleep tonight. And which was really interesting. Another one was a group that looked at the business of death. So they basically, the observation were in funeral homes and in the whole logistics chain, or supply chain, you could call it, of handling bodies after they're dead. And they would go to see what happens to bodies when they're donated to science, which is highly, like, not very comforting, what's going on there. And of course, also funeral homes and the whole business around taking care of dead bodies, which is an enormous but unseen kind of business. So sending them to those kinds of places and have them do observation of things that they thought they knew and that they would like to describe in nice ways. And suddenly they see what's actually going on and they learn how an area works. And that sort of takes their guards down and helps them, I think. So doing, you know, we looked at those people that looked at online dating and the algorithms of online dating, people that looked at desire, people that looked at what's it like to be seen. Some of the kids did really interesting but very simple work on what does having coffee mean? You know, when people say, do you want to have coffee? It turns out it doesn't necessarily involve coffee. And there's a whole sort of set of rituals and interesting, almost sort of mysterious aspects of that, you know, it doesn't even have to involve caffeine. Often alcohol is involved. You know, there are all kinds of things that are interesting about it, even though it's such a simple idea. So sending people out and looking at things in a raw, direct way and have them describe rather than have opinions was kind of a breakthrough for them. And they, you know, I still have emails every week from people that took the class in the past saying, you know, I just used this in my work as an investment banker or, you know, running a hospital chain. that they still use it as a tool. So I think that's all you can hope for as a you know, teacher.
Yeah, that is fascinating. So you're not just focusing on methods, but you're really focusing on a perspective, like look at the world differently, put your opinions aside and try to look at this in a really raw way. And what is the story?
Exactly. Exactly.
That sounds like a fantastic course.
Yeah. I mean, it's I'm probably going to teach it at a different university in the spring semester to try with a different crowd to do some of the same things. But the real inspiration in the book for this kind of research is a book called The Peregrine by J.A. Baker, which is about a man looking at peregrine falcons and their entire ecology and environment around them for 10 years and just describing it. And of course, peregrine falcons are extremely skilled killers and kill, you know, birds and all kinds of animals every day. And so instead of describing those birds as beautiful things, which he does, of course, but he also describes what's actually happening. And, you know, if you go and look at the business of dead bodies or funeral homes and just describe it in a nice and emotionally comforting way, you're not getting the point. You have to describe what's actually there. And that book is the most masterful observation I've ever read. It's my favorite book in the world. And really the beginning of this book was, I just want to write about that book. And I snuck it in there in one of the last chapters.
It does seem to me, though, there seems to be a difference between observing the act of coffee drinking and everything that's involved in that act, which people may or may not like coffee, but that's a different, maybe, different emotional experience than one might have in observing the handling of dead bodies. And you mentioned at the beginning, sort of have people observe things that aren't pleasant or that they don't find pleasant. I mean, that seems to me to be a key to potentially unlock the skill building of observation, is sort of forcing people to observe something about which they have strong opinions.
Right.
And do you find a difference between having people try to observe something that either they just don't know about or they don't have strong opinions about, and people trying to observe something about which they feel an unpleasantness or they have strong opinions about? Do you see differences in the sort of subject matter in terms of how the students react to it or their ability to do good observation?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I think that it's important that they choose a topic that they are interested in. And if you take the coffee thing, it actually ended on a pretty unpleasant note. So what they found was that having coffee was hooked into dating. And then they followed that track to say how, or basically follow people, talk to people and observe people that are dating. And they found by being in the same coffee shops and among the same people for a while, they learned that there's almost like a manufacturing or assembly line happening where some, especially the men, were figuring out the dating algorithms and were basically manipulating the dating algorithms in a way where they could have coffee with the kind of girls that they wanted to get close to. And that it was almost like a mechanical algorithmic relationship to courtship and finding love in this world that I think is new, that you have that level of technical description of the role of coffee, having coffee, technical description of how that plays into the whole courtship world, but described as algorithms. I thought that was really interesting, that what having coffee was might be different now because they are having coffee with someone that you're romantically or sexually interested in is algorithmic in nature and in language. So even something cute and nice as let's go have coffee had this sort of undertone of, I don't know, something we have to think about at least in terms of what courtship should be in our society. So the phenomena is an entry to a question or a, you know, an area, something you can study and observe. And then you go where it takes you. And in that case, it actually went to interesting insights into what happens in a coffee shop and how it says a lot about the life that we lead today.
All right, fine. You've convinced me that studying coffee can be just as interesting as studying something unpleasant. You threw another word in earlier about studying what actually is happening. And I've tried to use that in my writing, especially about, you know, kind of NDM as an approach, is that that's what we're really doing, is not presuming some initial starting set of variables and then looking to see if those are present or not, but we're actually studying what people are actually doing. And I think that that's a nice differentiator between what we're trying to do and what those other paradigms propose to do.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. I mean, that's why I think what you're doing is a cousin to what I've been doing. It's like it's the same family of approaches. And the core of that is, let's see what's there and describe what's there, whether it fits into our theory or not. And I really like that about the approach you are all taking.
So you mentioned you might be teaching again in the spring. What else is next for you? What kind of challenges are you looking forward to? How's the screenplay coming along?
Oh, the screenplay. It's so hard. I mean, I had to finish this book and I had a lot of pressure. So I put the screenplay to the side for a little bit, but I probably have to get back to it. And I mean, people tell me that it has enough substance to be a real screenplay. And it's just an experiment that'd be fun to try. Right now, I feel pretty busy because I have 5 boards and 2 startups and all kinds of things. But I haven't really figured out. I thought that I would be an academic. That was sort of my hypothesis, that the next 20, 30 years of my career would be being an academic. And then I learned how the academic world works. And I didn't find it as interesting as I thought I would. I found that it's hard to stand by the product, actually. I have a hard time convincing students to go into deep debt and then getting the kind of product, let's call it that in a crude way, you get from a university. I don't think it's worth the money, basically. And it's very difficult to work in an environment where you can't stand by the product. And second, I found the culture so passive aggressive that, I don't know, it wasn't fun. So I just had to cut my losses in last August and just say, this is not, maybe not for me. So the hypothesis was falsified and I have to figure out then what's the next, you know, I'd like one big chapter, just like Red was my first sort of big chapter that took 20, 25 years. I'd like another big chapter, and it turned out it's not academics. So, but I'm also way too young to just sit on boards. That's what you do when you're 65. So I have to figure it out.
Well, there must be something drawing you to the teaching piece, though, if you want to try a new set of students in a different university. I imagine working with those students, seeing them evolve in their thinking and ways of looking at the world, and maybe even seeing some shining stars in your classes who you realize, you know, they've got it. They've got those kinds of skills they're going to need. They understand what this paradigm's about. That has to be rewarding.
It's the best, right? So, I mean, also at Red, we had, I think, 2,000 people going through the system that that hired, and then eventually many of them left, of course, because it's a consulting model. And just seeing those people take off and just killing it is the best thing. It's the best thing about the work I did. It's the thing I'm most proud of, is what happened to those people and how amazing they are. Like, they come in a little fragile, confused, and then they come out as these monsters that are just amazing. So it's so fun to do that. And I need that in my life. I can't lead a life where I'm not connected to the process of taking, you know, someone that comes out of grad school and then just create, you know, enough energy around them and the right environment around them to take off.
I sort of feel like that go observe something unpleasant, it would be a great screening challenge for candidates to do this kind of work, because if they can show that they're able to make those kinds of observations of what's actually happening, you know, irrespective of how they feel about it, that's a pretty good sign.
I mean, observation is corrosive or undermining to prejudice and opinion. So often having people observe something they have really strong opinions about and getting through the pain and suffering it is to learn that you are actually wrong. I think that's also a really helpful method. So sometimes having them pick what they have strong opinions about and then just undermine it for them and then pick them back up again is also very helpful, I think. So you're right. I mean, the unpleasant, the undermining, you know, is often the best learning experiences you can have.
My graduate work was looking at new religious movements, you know, religious cults. And my professor, one of her favorite claims to fame is that she had never lost a student to any of the cults. So it is possible to send folks out and see if they can make those observations.
Could you imagine if she did lose? That would have been fun.
That would have been fun. All right, we're going to get close to time here. And I want to kind of end on a fun question. You've obviously led a very international life and seen so many aspects of human behavior in many different milieus. I wonder if tomorrow you were forced to live out the rest of your life in one place, where would that be and why?
New York City, for sure, which is also the plan. And it's not, I mean, the city's lovely and fun and so on, but it's because the people that the world comes through New York City, like it passes through. So everybody you'll ever want to meet at some point will pass through New York City, and you get to see an extreme version of humans in every aspect. So if you're into a particular kind of music, all the subcultures and subgroups of that type of music will be present, and you just have to figure out to find it. Or if you're into sociology, then the greatest sociologists will pass through. So that, I think, it's going to be New York City. The most interesting relationship I've had to a city is Seoul, Korea, because I've been coming there for a long, long time. And just seeing that city go from being a local, rather provincial place to just the place it is today, where it's one of the most successful, amazing cities in the world. Over the course of 20 years, you can really see that you can change societies for the better very fast. And it's such an optimistic place to be. So Seoul might be its second choice.
Well, it sounds like you've cracked the code. Rather than going to all these places in the world, you've decided that just New York provides you that concentration of everything. So you've cracked the code on how to do naturalistic research is just find a place where everything happens and you don't have to go anywhere.
That's true. I'd like to go someplace once in a while, though. Travel is the best. But the city has this extra aspect. The New York City has this extra aspect that everyone interesting comes through there once.
Mm. Well, thank you so much, Christian, for speaking with us today. It's a pleasure. I wish we had hours and hours to dive even deeper into some of these topics, but folks can go get your book and at least dive deeper into the observational piece. So thank you so much for joining us for the NDM podcast. I'm Brian Moon.
And I'm Laura Militello. Learn more about naturalistic decision-making and where to follow us by visiting naturalisticdecisionmaking.org.